and it's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. That's right. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, working class heroes. I say that already. Man, it's all, my brain's going to jello. What's up, Riley?
What's up, man? Your brain isn't going to jello.
No,
man.
I feel good. I feel good. I'm all jacked up.
Yeah, man, we watched the sunrise a little while ago.
Oh, you make it sound so sweet.
No, this is New York. There's no such thing as a sweet sunrise here.
It's me and Riley sitting there watching the sunrise on the roof of the building.
Yeah.
It's a little hazy, but I like it. Look good.
Yeah, well, you know, we were supposed to get all these thunderstorms and stuff last night. It wasn't so bad, though.
There was a thunderstorm. Where were you?
I was out like a light. I must have been.
Yeah, it definitely started raining, though.
It rained, but it did. You know, they were talking about hail and, you know,
No. A couple of announcements before we get on into this. I will be performing live at Bananas Comedy Club in Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey on Saturday, June 25th. Go to bananascomedyclub.com for ticket info. We might have some giveaways here on the air soon.
Yeah.
Morning Sedition, that's this show. We'll broadcast live this Friday from New York Strand Bookstore at the corner of Broadway and 12th Street from 6 to 9 a.m. We'll have playwright and actor Eric Bogosian and New York City mayoral. I got this problem with mayoral. I got into the mayoral habit. Mayoral candidate, C. Virginia Fields, joining us. And I think Jim David might be coming down. You know Jim David, the comedian. Plus, we'll be giving away tons of free stuff, including a raffle for 2 tickets, plus transport to my stand-up performance in New Jersey. How do you like that? You could win a trip to New Jersey to see me.
A raffle?
How do you like that?
Whoa.
Dude, I've been waiting for this envelope from UPS that my wife sent the Friday before Memorial Day, priority mail. Where is it? Who screwed up? What's going on with
that? Wait. Is it UPS or USPS?
Oh.
USPS is the postal service. You sent it priority mail.
So they're both screwed up. That's all I'm saying is what's with these mail carriers, because I'm waiting for the USPS, and now I read this article today that UPS loses 4 million peoples. Did you say that? Four million persons. The identity
Personal data,
social security numbers, banking records, credit records, addresses, names, the whole kit and caboodle. 4 million people from what, Citicorp, is that what it was?
City Financial, yeah. It's part of Citigroup. And the amazing thing about this story, Mark, is that the package containing these tapes with all this data on 4 million people seems to have vanished into thin air. Everybody says, you know, we've got these tracking systems, all of these different delivery services. We got a tracking system. We never lose anything. If it's, you know, if it gets in our system, we'll find it. Well, this one didn't.
Dude, and the other scary thing, one box.
Yeah.
It's one box with files and reams and super high-tech little packages. What is it? It's like data in the form of its computer.
Computer tapes, apparently.
Computer tapes.
Yeah.
Wow. And I
4 million people.
That was a computer tape. I just got used to discs and stuff, and the zip discs and the CDs. You got any idea what a computer tape is, Kayla? Do you know what a computer tape is? He's still festering about the fact that Brendan McDonald's going to pay $10 a wisdom tooth to get his taken out, and you paid how much?
$800.
Oh, man. Wow. Wow, you got
the just for what? For 4 wisdom teeth?
Yeah. I don't know what computer tape is.
Okay, thanks a lot, man. I'm glad you piped in.
Picking up something and throwing it at
him. He's going to be cranky all day, man. I can just tell. This tooth thing is really taking the steam out of his morning. Mm-hmm. What are you just thinking about all the things you could have had, Chris?
Exactly.
All right, here's another sad story, I think. I guess the Supreme Court has decided that the federal government can step in and say, well, it's a medical marijuana issue. It's no longer – explain to me exactly the ruling. The idea was, can the federal government, you know, supersede the state laws on medical marijuana use?
And by a 6-3 vote, the Supreme Court said, yes, the federal government can, and they can actually prosecute people for actions that would be legal under the laws of the states in which they live. There are 10 states that have medical marijuana laws.
But it does not say that Congress cannot make a decision on this again, that they can, that Congress can vote on whether or not it is legal to use marijuana medically and prescribed medically.
Those punks?
Yeah.
There's no way in the world the Congress, and the Supreme Court knows this, there is no way in the world this Congress, the 109th Congress, will ever, during its history, pass a medical marijuana.
No, I understand that. But this also goes to show just how selfish and career-oriented people in the Congress are. That if people can't assess the benefits of medical marijuana just because of the stigmatization of marijuana as a drug. I mean, this is a natural resource that these people weren't even buying. One woman who was involved in this case was growing it in her backyard for her own personal use because she is deathly ill.
She had a very debilitating spinal disease. But that means nothing, Mark Maron, when the hundreds of millions of dollars that are used to fight marijuana in this country are at stake. That's the issue.
Okay,
the issue
is
the Office of National Drug Control Policy, who will never admit to a medical benefit for marijuana, no matter how many people say it has helped them personally. It doesn't matter, because their millions in government money is at stake here.
Yeah, but it also has to do with them being pimped out by the pharmaceutical industry as well, doesn't it? I mean, if the pharmaceutical industry can't make any money off of this, why not jack through drugs that the FDA barely approves that could make people sick and sell that to people for overamped prices, as opposed to let someone grow something in their backyard that they can smoke and feel better?
Well, absolutely, and this is an industry. Not only is the pharmaceutical industry, do they have a stake in this, but again, government has a stake in this because of the amount of money that Congress allocates to the war on drugs.
Okay, so it's the pharmaceutical industry and government, i.e. nothing to do with caring about people.
Of course not. They know better than this. All they
tend to care about people.
And ironically enough, Sandra Day O'Connor, Rehnquist, and Clarence Thomas voted to allow the states to allow medical marijuana.
That's because Rehnquist is probably getting high. He's got cancer.
Oh, God.
Come on. What?
You think they were wheeling him through the Capitol?
He's too stoned to walk.
Room?
He's too stoned to walk. Put him in the chair. How disrespectful am I?
Oh,
isn't
well,
that
hey,
something?
Man,
so finally, we can put this Washington State gubernatorial race to rest. Is that the deal on that?
Christine Gregoire, the Democrat, won by not 129, but 133 votes. They recounted, and she got four more.
Oh, she got four more. That's good.
Out of 2.9 million casts.
Now, because this was upheld by a judge, does that mean it's over, Riley?
Essentially, it is. My guess is, the Republicans can probably appeal, but by the time they get done, her term will be done. She'll probably be running for re-election, for God's sake.
How petty would that Republican candidate, Dino Rossi, look if he tried to appeal this again? Just slander and running around accusing Christine Gregoire's campaign.
Fraud. But Rossi
says
now apparently he's not gonna appeal. He's not gonna contest.
That's it.
It's
he's
Governor
done.
Gregoire.
It's so nice when a Republican, after screaming that there's election fraud, actually gets beaten, considering what they did in Ohio and everywhere else.
Oh, yeah. And, considering the fact that this was a race that took place last November. They've been fighting about it ever since. And, well, they should. With numbers this close. But remember that the numbers in Florida were even closer.
Yeah. And this was but there was no indication, really, that there was a orchestrated fraud in Washington. It was just very close, and it went twice.
Yeah.
So now Porter Goss is definitely taking the back seat, as assumed a while back when he took the job, and John Negroponte was put in place as the nation's intelligence czar at the National Security Council.
Well, yeah, what Negroponte has been very quietly doing is consolidating his power over the intelligence community at the expense of not just Porter Goss, but the entire CIA. Apparently, the presidential briefings on intelligence will no longer include Porter Goss.
Well, this is sort of an evolution that came out of Rumsfeld's military intelligence unit. What was it, the Defense Intelligence Agency?
Yeah, you're using the term intelligence loosely.
Right. Well, once the CIA was used as a scapegoat and used to just funnel information that this administration wanted in order to justify war, it sort of lost credibility, and then they pushed it off onto Goss, and then there was all that infighting. We've talked to people at the CIA that are completely pissed off about what happened there and how it was represented and how its integrity was diminished by this administration, and now it's just being pushed aside altogether.
Goss's new office may be in the Potomac at the rate they're going. There's just nothing left for him to do. Maybe he's playing solitaire on his computer.
If he figured out how to work it. Remember, there was an issue there.
Sure,
a while back, he's like, I don't get this newfangled mouse thing.
Yeah.
He says he's going to work on straightening up organizational problems, and that means, dealing with a bunch of bitter CIA guys who remember when the place was important. That's right. So, when we come back, we'll get into the West Side Stadium, which looks like it's a...
Done!
It's over.
Yeah.
Game,
I told you!
Game over. No likely Olympics for New York City, and no likely stadium for the West Side, which is a good thing for many New Yorkers. That and more coming up next here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
243-1483. That's 1-800-243-1483. Call Stop Sign right now. 1-800-243-1483.
Past the hour. Good morning. It's Tuesday. You okay? You all right? We're all right. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
I'm all right.
Okay, good. It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. We will broadcast live this Friday from New York Strand Bookstore at the corner of Broadway and 12th Street from 6 to 9 a.m. We're going to have Eric Bogosian there and New York City Mayoral.
Mayoral.
How come I get that? Why did I get mayoral? Where was I getting mayoral?
Oh,
mayoral.
No, you're not the only one that does it.
All right. Mayoral candidate, C. Virginia Fields joining us, and plus we're going to have Jim David most likely. I believe he's going to be the comedian Jim David. Also, he writes a column for The Advocate. Very funny guy. That's all coming up on Friday. Right now, we're going to do the iNews 5000 in just a few minutes, but let's get into this stadium thing. This is big news here in New York and big news for America in terms of the Olympics. One, the Olympics are not going to be coming here, clearly.
No, they're not coming to New York. It is, and I don't want to say I told you so, but it is between Paris and London. Now, what's interesting about this is that a year ago, I looked this up on the Internet, a year ago, it was between Paris and Madrid. So in the intervening year, London managed to actually convince the International Olympic Committee that their bid was better than Madrid. That means that had New York had the stadium in place a year ago, or if it had been moving toward it, and if they had gotten more public support, it's possible New York could have been where London is now, which is, the number two contender. As it stands now, it's Paris, London, New York, Madrid, Moscow.
Yeah, but Moscow's way out.
Moscow's out of it.
And then even Madrid, they said... a lot of the hotels are just too far away for them to fit within the requirements of the Olympics. What's interesting about the New York bid here now is that not only were you right, Riley, but it seems like Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver has gotten his way.
Well, he has held out because his Assembly District, for those of you who don't live in New York, the Assembly is part of the state legislature, the equivalent of the House of Representatives on a state level. His district includes the area around Ground Zero. There has been little or no construction done on Ground Zero, and Sheldon Silver's beef was, hey, how are you going to talk about building not just a stadium, but 24 million square feet of office space on the west side of Manhattan while Ground Zero lays there unrepaired? And that was his beef.
Yeah, and also just getting tenants down there. So he's basically saying that if you're going to build an office complex and a stadium and create all those jobs on the west side, how the hell are you going to think? What are you thinking? You're never going to get to fill those office spaces down by Ground Zero, which needs it right now.
Well, yeah.
That's already built. It's got to be built. That's an existing place.
And the problem, too, is a parochial political problem. The city of New York did not think they had to go to the state legislature to get approval for anything, and they did. Sheldon Silver said, and this is almost a direct quote from last night, they thought they didn't have to deal with the state legislature. They thought they didn't have to deal with me. They were wrong.
Right. So the Olympics will not be coming to the United States, and we will not be seeing a stadium on the west side of Manhattan for probably a long time, if ever. I personally am happy about it. In retrospect, thinking about the disaster it would have caused any day there was a game, and also just the amount of construction on the west side, and then sort of, diminishing. There's a certain quaintness and solid, and nice. It's kind of nice down there without a stadium down over west.
Over by the rail yards. Yeah, it's kind of sort of peaceful out there. But I'll tell you what, Mike Bloomberg's, Mayor Michael Bloomberg's advisors may be breathing a sigh of relief right now that this is done with now in June, so they don't have to revisit it come November, because most people outside of New York may not know this, but Mike Bloomberg is running for re-election right now.
I think he's a shoo-in.
Oh, yeah, and that's interesting because New Yorkers are parsing. They may have opposed the stadium as a group, but they don't have a problem with Mike Bloomberg as mayor. Half the black people in New York City, according to a poll released yesterday, approve of his job as mayor. That's unprecedented for a Republican.
Yeah, and I'll tell you something. From a guy coming in after, you know, the little dictator, after Giuliani left, and everybody thinking like, ah, Bloomberg, he's no Giuliani. Where's the attitude? Where's the, he's really, he's done all right for
he's
himself.
Done okay, yeah.
Hey, look, speaking of the Olympics, we got our buddy Omar from Westchester, who is out west in the big marathon. What's going on, Omar? How'd that marathon go?
What up, Omar?
Oh, baby, good morning. Good morning. How y'all doing?
That was it. The San Diego Marathon for the American Stroke Association. Did you win, Omar?
Did I win? Not hardly, but I finished.
There you go. Nice work, Omar.
If you're not, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Let me tell you something. If you're not from Kenya or Ethiopia,
yeah,
don't even think you finish the finish line first. Don't even think you'll cross that bad boy first. I just want to give y'all guys a thanks. For shouting me out. I got a call when I got out there stating that you guys were rooting me on and things of that sort and everything. But it was great. I'm telling you, the experience was wonderful.
Good, good.
American the Stroke Association, we was out there about 800 deep as far as the country is concerned.
So, oh, really? So they made some good money for a good cause.
Yeah, we raised about $1.9 million.
That's pretty good.
Wow, a deuce.
There is a couple of points that a lot of people don't know about as far as the Stroke Association is concerned, that the stroke is the number three killer in America. Every 3.3 minutes, someone dies of a stroke.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are 4.4 million stroke survivors, and 29% of the people who have strokes are under the age of 65.
That's scary.
Yeah.
So the cause was great, and, you know, we had a great time meeting a lot of different people.
Are you sore? You all right?
Oh, man. The second mile of the race,
yeah,
I blew my knee out.
Oh. Second mile in? But you finished all the, yeah, but you ran the other, what, 22 or 24?
24.2.
Oh, my
right
God.
Right, Omar. Good
to you,
guts, man. Nice work.
Good to you.
It was no other choice.
All right, well...
I just wanted to say that usually people run for stroke victims. If there was a victim that I didn't run, he wasn't a stroke victim.
We got to go. We got to go, Omar.
Okay.
Well, thank you. Man. I'm glad you did it, man.
Nice work.
You take it easy. Okay,
right,
man. Omar made it. Can you believe he made it? So we got the iNews coming up. It looks like Brian is, Brian from Everett, who's our singing buddy, says that Al Franken is not King of the Jews. Maybe we'll talk to him in a second. Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Be born, because more babies means more $39,000 chickens to pay down the debt.
The Majority Report on Air America Radio.
Al Franken, nothing to lose. Makes you laugh at the troubling news. Sometimes I wonder if he's hitting the booze. Al Franken, King of the Jews.
Thank you, Brian. You've made our morning. 34 past the hour. Did we try to do two layers of music? Do I hear music in my head right now?
That was the Barry White mix.
Oh, okay. Well, now, if people, a lot of people may not know Brian in Everett, who is a regular listener, has been a listener for our show, and now has become a contributor because, I guess a week or so ago, I said that Brian had an inconsistent mental disposition, which led to a series of songs. Also, the one you just heard, Al Franken, King of the Jews. Brian, are you there?
Well, I've been shocked into a realization that it may be something that happened to you years ago when your life took a different path. But
maybe.
What? This is the thing.
Yes.
Every man has an inner Jew.
Okay.
We all need to be the king of our own inner Jew. And no one, and it's like where the teaching should be Jew not lest you be Jewed, or Jew unto others as you would have others Jew unto you.
I'm not sure. I'm going to have to parse that a little bit.
Well, no, but what I'm saying is...
If I'm going to get my act together and do a comedy routine, I want to try out some material real quick. Can I do that? Because I'm going to open mic tonight.
I wanted to tell you one thing, though, Brian.
And
you might did you know there's a report out today that says more than half of Americans will develop a mental illness at some point in their lives?
Well, that's because of our stress of our civilization and the situations we're put in where we're just taken to the breaking point.
That's what I said. But then I got argument from my people here.
Organic?
Well, no, that doesn't exist at all. What is normal, and how much of this is just a plan on behalf of pharmaceutical companies to get everybody on medication?
It's pharmaceutical plan, and it's social pharmacy, you know. And I've seen it. I've seen the pressure, like on Oprah. Some two ladies are pressuring. You need help in doing this work. You get on the medication, and you know. And here's the thing: I went to the pharmacy yesterday to pick up my prescription, and my dose was altered.
What by who?
I guess my shrink had written a different dose, but I didn't realize it.
More or less?
It's less.
Less?
It's good, but that's why I had the dream, because if I don't take the right amount of this script, then I get these dreams, and my dream was about psychiatry.
Really?
It was about psychiatrists messing with me to get me to love my family.
Oh, man.
Wow.
Imagine that. Who the hell wants to do that?
Why would that be messing with you, Brian?
Maybe you see the good side of psychiatry from what the public lets you see. But
No. I see the good side of family.
Well, the good side
I don't
of family,
care about shrinks.
Yeah. Well, look, Brian, give us one joke and then we'll move on.
This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go into the. I'm going to do my shtick. I'm going to say, hey, you know it's time to get your act together when you're 40 years old and sleeping on your friend's couch.
Yeah. No, it's pretty good. I think it might be someone else's joke, but it's okay.
Okay. Well, have a good day.
Oh, no.
Wait a minute, man.
Hey, how did your material go over that last weekend?
I did okay.
Was there anything about Mother Teresa?
No, there wasn't. Not last weekend.
You can use my material if you want. I don't care.
Well, that would make it weird, and it'd be difficult. I'd have to pay you to write for me, and it'd be weird, you know. I like it better. I like your own material. I think you're doing a lot of great stuff out there, Brian, on your couch in Everett.
Thanks.
Okay,
buddy.
Right. Take it
easy. Okay, bye.
Wait a minute, man. We heard somebody with that 40-year-old couch thing.
I think we have a guest? I don't know. Is it my joke?
It might be. There you go.
It was from a thing. It was from a You Know You're Bitter If. I did a list years ago on Conan. I'm not saying that Brian copped the joke. It's not a joke as much as an observation. I'm sure he's living in that observation, but you know, it's good to talk to him. He's got a lot of energy. You know, sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, here's the machine, Riley. We've got the iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. This is going out to Brian in Everett today. From the New York Times, Olympic bid hurt as New York fails. And what's that? Yeah, it's the last bit. It's the last bit there. Olympic bid hurt as New York fails in West Side Stadium quest. Yes. Okay, translation. New York fans must still go to New Jersey Meadowlands to see Ozfest. From the New York Times, Russell Crowe accused of assault with hotel phone. Russell Crowe accused of assault with hotel phone. Translation, Cinderella Man turns into bitchy stepsister. From Fox News, Detroit tops Miami to return to NBA Finals. Translation, Detroit braces for weeks of riots, possible outbreak of basketball. Do you have an inconsistent mental disposition? This is an actual real story that I'm looking at. And we had a long conversation about it off mic here before the show that it's more than they've decided in a report that more than half Americans will develop mental illness at some point in their life. This is a researcher. This is a survey. I'm trying to figure out who did that survey. The problem with this is, in my head, is essentially, what is normal, what isn't normal? And yes, everybody has problems, and yes, everybody goes through painful points of their life. I'm a big believer in therapy. I'm a big believer in temporary medication to help you move through obsessive compulsive disorder if you have it. If you need to be on, medication because you're extensively and deeply depressed. Because I've gotten into trouble about this before. I choose not to be on medication for any of my weird little quirks.
No self-medication.
No self-medication, certainly not.
Okay.
Just, you know, ice cream and the regular, you know, coffee, ice cream,
okay.
And, you know, autoerotic.
Coffee, ice cream.
Autoerotic hobbying, which I like to call it. And, you know,
thanks, Mark.
Yeah, but the thing is that a lot of people, I believe that, you know, everyone, like I said, what is normal and what is mental illness? If you need help, you should get help. And then it's up to you to decide how long you need to have that help for. It's also, it should be up to the medical profession, too, but I think a lot of people get concerned with the idea that we get, that culturally there's a victim mode, that you know, some people stay in therapy too long because they develop some sort of weird relationship with their therapist. Some people stay on meds too long because they are unwilling to either address their problems on a different level or work them through in a different way. But I do think that this is... on behalf, when studies come out like this, it makes you doubt or question the integrity of psychiatry because, you know, a lot of these things, I believe this one as well, was funded by a pharmaceutical company on some level.
Well, you know, what's funny about this is that the medical community appears to be split on this 50% thing. There's a quote in this article that says, 50% of Americans mentally impaired? Are you kidding me? Now, this is from a psychiatrist. At Johns Hopkins. So not everybody's on the bus with
this. Right. There's a government study funded by the Department of Mental Health. Is that what that is? National Institute of Mental Health. The issue is that, for me, yeah, of course a lot of people aren't on board with this because they're right not to be involved on board with this because they say, is everything a mental illness? And where do you draw the line? That's the whole thing. What is the barometer of normal? You know, if you got a twitch or you get angry at certain things, you have certain neurotic dispositions that aren't necessarily dangerous to you or others, maybe that's just your personality. And who's to tell you whether or not it's normal or abnormal? Maybe that is, you know, the quirks that make you you. It's when those things become dangerous to yourself or others where you have to really take into consideration whether or not you're sick.
Well, yeah, I just wonder, because when I was a kid, when I was like in my teens, my mother had me go see a psychiatrist once because she thought I had an inconsistent mental disposition.
Yeah.
I think she was probably right, but I only went once, and that was the end of that. I just had no use for it after that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a matter of use. I guess it depends, like, what you want out of your life. You know what I mean? A lot of people are paralyzed by certain mental problems that may not be considered, like, sicknesses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's insecurity, low self-esteem, or fear. You know, it's how are you going to move through that? And I think Brian was right, oddly, because he has some, you know, mental problems. But I think that that's all right. I mean, he owns that. And,
yeah,
you know,
I know.
But how much of it is because of the pace of the society we live in now? For some people, especially sensitive people, if you can't keep up, you can't compete, you feel left out, you feel like you're not in sync with the rest of the world, which you probably shouldn't be. Like I've always said that if someone says to you, you might be clinically depressed, you should probably say thank you. That means I'm awake. Is there any indication we shouldn't be depressed? But, it just becomes a decision is it hurting you? Are you hurting other people? Are you paralyzed are you incapacitated because of it? Then you might seek help. Whether you're mentally ill or not on a chronic level, that's the sad thing is a lot of times you're going to have to decide that for yourself.
That's the sad part. But I think, too, that people don't always make use of their ability to break free of stuff.
That's what I mean. That's what I mean. You develop.
Just break out and do. You know, I saw this weird movie the other day about this woman who was a dancer who apparently just decided to move out into the middle of nowhere, and she bought this old opera house / theater and turned it into this great performance space. Now, you know, here's a sensitive woman who probably at the point where her dancing career ended could have, you know, lapsed into depression or whatever, but she went out and she created this extraordinary space. Sometimes, you know, inconsistent mental disposition can help.
Well, also, I think there, what you just said there that is very significant is that a lot of people are completely consumed with themselves. A lot of people are completely consumed with their career, how they're going to do in the world, how's everything for me, when is my turn, how come that person gets that, whereas some people, and I think we'll talk to our guest later, Chris Hedges, in an hour or so, is going to come talk to us about spirituality and the relation of the Ten Commandments to life without religion, is that, you know, maybe if you get out there in the world and do something for somebody else, you might find an entirely new sense of self around that. You might feel useful. You might, just to get out of yourself for 5 minutes and do something good for someone else, sometimes can change your entire outlook. It's miraculous. I think a lot of reasons why people think they're sick is because they isolate themselves and they're completely self-obsessed.
Uh-oh. Now you know what that means.
That means that I'm guilty of it, and the only way I know how to do this The only reason I'm talking about this is because I live it day to day. But I will tell you one thing that does not help an inconsistent mental disposition over the long term. That's pot. If you, a surefire way to fall more into yourself is chronic pot use, but it does help people who are in chronic pain from cancer, glaucoma, spinal injuries, and now the Supreme Court has made a ruling. Let's get into a little bit of that coming up next here on Air America Radio.
You know, whoever with this phone system can themselves in the mouth and eat their own waste. You know, that's what I say. So leave me alone. I'm trying to get a good take and replay it back on my touch tone pad. So can I play and get a good recording so I can hear how it sounds? I got an inconsistent mental disposition.
Next message.
Morning Sedition. Your subscription and keep the video, booklet, and magazine free.
So call 800-423-3100. That's 800-423-3100.
Fifty past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hiya.
It's Air America Radio. Couple of quick things. The stadium issue is over in New York.
Done.
No Olympics to be had here in the USA.
Well, you know, there's still a glimmer of hope, but that glimmer is fast fading.
Yep. Here's for those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's morning's edition, Cliff Notes. President Bush is excluding the CIA from National Security Council meeting. This is the worst snub against the CIA since the time the FBI refused to tell them who they hired to kill JFK. The CIA will return to doing what it does best, spying on American citizens and smuggling drugs. The Supreme Court rules against medical marijuana. The sad thing is that patients with chronic problems will now also have chronic problems. A DEA official said, finally, the Supreme Court has removed our handcuffs and now we can launch our war against cancer and AIDS patients and the elderly. A sperm bank company is offering Viking sperm for the creation of Aryan babies. It's good news for men who can't father their own babies, but bad news for a lot of kids who are going to be named Thor Moskowitz. For any of you who are disgusted by this trend toward blonde, blue-eyed babies, visit marinsperm.com, and a trained representative will discuss an alternative plan that's right for you. Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Oh, great, a sperm bank that pumps out blue-eyed blondes. Just what we need. A world where everyone looks like Dolph Lundgren. Wake up, sheeple. There's no you in eugenics. Those are your morning Sedition Cliff Notes for today. Back to the medical marijuana issue. The Supreme Court has ruled in a decision that Sandra Day O'Connor, Rehnquist, and Clarence Thomas did not vote for this.
No, they actually were dissenters. It was a 6-3 decision that said that the federal government can prosecute medical marijuana users in states where medical marijuana use is legal on a state level.
But this does not close all the loopholes through which some can work. Congress may pass a law that allows this, number one, but you say that will never happen because this Congress only cares
has
about
no
money
spine.
And their career, so they don't want to be aligned with natural occurring substances that actually help people. They'd rather be aligned with pharmaceutical companies and funneling money into their states to anti-drug DEA funding. We've now got, there's a guy here here in New York that actually, you know, we've talked to here before on the show. It looks like he's calling in. He was a gubernatorial candidate of the Marijuana Reform Party. Let's see what he has to weigh in on this. Tom Layton, good morning. How are you?
Hey, Tom.
Okay, good morning, guys. Thanks for having me back on today.
Sure. Yeah. Now, what does this mean for people that are ill and that, you know, want to grow their own marijuana? And Mark Riley seems to think that if you've only got a few plants, that you might be able to pull it off.
Well, obviously, who they decide to go after is their decision. But, I mean, it's basically thousands of people in at least 11 states are just being thrown to the wolves.
Yeah.
It's a real tragedy.
Because of the pain that they're in. And this is, you know, I mean, it's been pretty substantiated. I always am baffled that they keep saying, like, we don't know how safe it is. It's like, you know, the drugs that they put out on the regular pharmaceutical market, like Vioxx and some other drugs, have horrendous repercussions. At least people who smoke pot are taking the chances into their own hands, and we kind of know it's going to be all right.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, are we free to cure ourselves or not? I mean,
exactly. And so, what was it when you ran for governor on this platform? What was your stance on this exactly?
Well, last time I ran on three issues: ending the Rockefeller laws, allowing farmers to grow hemp in New York, and medical marijuana for New Yorkers. And we were for it all the way. I mean, obviously, our organization advocated full legalization, but we realized that's not happening right now, and we thought, at least, as long as we're not going to solve this problem, the people who are sick and suffering, help them in the meantime.
Right.
So. Now, Tom, you were aware, of course, that there are 10 states, or 11 states, I guess, altogether,
yeah,
that have medical marijuana laws. The state that you ran in, New York, is not one of them. Why not?
Well, a lot of the states had it primarily because they had voter initiatives process. So voters, people could vote for that. And that's what's fascinating about this. I mean, democracy is the big thing for Bush these days for everybody. People voted for this.
Yeah.
Okay. And Clinton's drug enforcement agency and Bush's have said, hey, sorry, you think you live in a democracy that you can get what you vote for?
Yeah.
No. That's just for elections and for, like, telling other countries what's going on. We don't have that here.
And also they tend to condescend to people that run on these platforms. They condescend in the way that they trivialize them and they make them look like a bunch of, you know, stoner hippies that just sort of like, hey, man, smoke pot.
Well, that's one thing we got over. We had a very serious image and we got taken seriously and did well in debates. And so we moved the legislation forward in the state, there's no doubt.
I hope they free the weed, man.
Oh, well, don't count on it. There's a lot of fascinating stuff about this. Is what the Supreme Court is saying is really a major cop-out, and it's hypocritically contrary because they've had a recent trend of pro-states' rights rulings this court in terms of not allowing federal legislation to get guns near schools or euthanasia. They've been going states' rights. So to toss this to the Congress is really a cop-out because the Congress is historically antagonistic to this. I mean, the National Institute of Health, the Institute of Medicine, we've had a DEA administrative law judge. They've been telling Congress for years that medical marijuana is not a problem and pot should not be a scheduled drug, but Congress is listening. So for the Supreme Court to tell these patients here, go to the Congress, that's just like, you know, it's ridiculous. And it's also basically putting in position to pursue penny ante small-time pot users on a local level. You think, aren't they more interested in Al-Qaeda cells?
Part of the thing is that this administration is going against a certain Republican legacy of honoring states' rights and putting in more legislation that gives more power to the government.
Going against its own campaign promise.
Exactly.
In 2000, he said he was opposed to medical marijuana, but he thought the federal government should not interfere with states' rights to do so. As a candidate, that's what Bush said. Then he turns around. You know,
wow, he lied, huh? Imagine that.
Yeah.
Bastard. Yeah. All right, Tom, thanks for talking to us.
I appreciate it.
Take care. Well, that's true. You know, it's an amazing thing to me, too, that, you know, this administration is going against, you know, years of Republican ideology in playing these games, but giving more power to the federal government.
Haven't you ever seen the film Reefer Madness?
I have.
Well, that's how a lot of these people view marijuana use.
Well, you know, it's regressive and stupid. I mean, the one thing, the amazing thing to me is that they can't even get research. They can't even wrap their brains around what substances are in marijuana that actually help people because it's so complicated and natural.
It's like sex.
Yeah, we can't make money off of this in a legitimate way. So we're gonna deny you the one thing that makes your pain go away. That's what Morning Sedition does. It makes your pain go away. It gets you worked up. It starts your day out. Six past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hiya.
The show is Morning Sedition. The network is Air America Radio. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, one and all. Morning Sedition will broadcast live this Friday from New York Strand Bookstore at the corner of Broadway and 12th Street from 6 to 9. We'll have playwright and actor Eric Bogosian and New York City mayoral candidate C. Virginia Fields joining us. Plus, we'll be giving away tons of stuff, including a raffle for two tickets plus transport to my stand-up performance in New Jersey on June 25th at Bananas in Hasbrook Heights. So how do you like that? You can come to the Strand Bookstore, and win a trip to New Jersey to see me.
Wow. And those that transportation isn't courtesy of a bus.
Hey, no. We're going to take you out there all nice and stuff.
All right.
Take this, the lactivist. You know, we talked about this yesterday. Couple hundred, according to this New York Times article, lactating women showed up at the studio of ABC to protest Barbara Walters' condescending comments about how she was uncomfortable with people breastfeeding in public. She was uncomfortable, and they said it was gross and disgusting. And we talked to Caridwen Morris yesterday, who was at the event. She is from thenewmom.com. She will be back later in the show to tell us exactly what happened out there. It sounded pretty good. It sounded like an effective protest. I'm glad we were part of that.
Absolutely.
Other New York news that affects the country, the Olympics will not be coming to the United States of America, and the Westside Stadium looks like it will not be built anytime soon. Right, Riley?
Well, that seems to be what's in order. There is still an outside chance New York might get the Olympics, and an outside chance that all this political foolishness that's going on here in New York could be reversed, and they might have a stadium and the Olympics, but I wouldn't bet a Johnny K Street nickel on any of that happening.
I get you. Here's another story that upsets me because I've been obsessed with this. Now, the United States Postal Service owes me a package that my wife sent before Memorial Day.
Uh-oh.
And it's driving me nuts because it's got some stuff in there I need, and I get freaked out about identity theft. I get freaked out about my information floating out there, God knows where, I don't know what. But I'll tell you something, I'm not as worried as 3.9 people are going to be worried about when they hear about UPS losing the information, sensitive information, social security numbers, addresses, account numbers. They lost a box that had the information of 3.9 million people. This is UPS.
Million, yeah.
3.9 million people.
Million people. It is incredible.
Computer tapes.
Hey, man, and you wonder how identity theft takes place. Mm. As a recent victim, I can tell you how identity theft hurts domestic bliss. When your wife looks at you and says, did you spend blank, blank, blank on blank? No. Are you sure?
Uh-huh.
No, I didn't spend that money at that time. And then I found out somebody had actually copied my number and made their own card of mine.
I'm always freaked out about this, but this is big news. I mean, they don't know where this box is. They tried to track it. They can't track it.
Can't track it.
This was Citi Financial, the consumer finance subsidiary of Citigroup, sent a box with a bunch of computer tapes in it with 3.9 million people's information. It got lost en route to Texas. And, I think there's some shady business going on, because it's such a huge money business, this identity theft thing. It just scares the hell out of me because there's so few ways that you can really isolate and protect yourself. I mean, you can only take certain actions. You get a shredder, change your passwords. There's many websites. Use cash. But I tell you, sometimes I just think, why not just bundle up that money and put it in a mattress? Stock market's going in the crapper anyways. it's like, what do you stand to gain with interest? I want to say that the Washington gubernatorial race is done.
Yes, Christine Gregoire got 133 more votes out of 2.9 million cast than her Republican opponent, Dino Rossi. Dino Rossi has thrown in the towel. He says he's not going to appeal, so Christine Gregoire will serve out her appointed term, her elected term. Excuse me.
That's good. It's good. I'm glad that the Republican who was, crying fraud was told by a judge that to shut up. And,
Dino?
And take it like a man.
Governor Dino?
It's not always being a liberal, Riley. We all stray from the straight and narrow from time to time. But when we need to unburden ourselves, we can always confess our liberal sins. If you want to take a turn in the liberal confessional, give us a call at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. But right now it's my turn. Bless me, Brother Riley, for I have sinned.
How can I ease your burden, my son?
So, look, how yesterday we were talking about women breastfeeding, about how good it is for the baby and it's good for the mother. And,
yes,
and,
Mark.
And then how Star Jones and Barbara Walters came out against public breastfeeding on The View.
Yes, that's none of their business,
And it's not really any of my business either, but... Yes, I'm looking. I'm definitely checking that out every time. I know it's supposed to be a beautiful moment, a bonding between mother and child, but not for me.
It's good that you're here, Mark. Women do have a right to feed their children without you putting your eyes all over them.
You want to know the truth? I get mad at the baby because its big head is in the way. The thing that really drives me crazy is that the other one is just sitting there not being used. I'm so wrong, man. It's so bad. What the
hell's
wrong?
No, Mark.
No, it's bad.
Don't be so hard on yourself. That's the way every 12-year-old thinks.
I know. I can't help it. Part of me wants to just yell, boobies, and then run away.
Well, you know, I have an idea for your pen.
Hit me, Brother Riley.
I want you to take some 40 grit sandpaper.
Oh, God, no. No, I don't. No, don't make
it. And
me
I want you to rub it vigorously over your nipples.
No. Oh, man. No.
And then I want you to put a clothespin on each
one. Oh, man.
Because that's what it feels like for women. Maybe then you'll understand they're not doing it for your entertainment.
But, dude, what if it turns out that, I kind of like the clothespins and the sandpaper?
Well, you know what, Mark?
Yeah.
There's always next week's confessional.
Oh, man. Thank you, Brother Riley. I feel better. I feel cleansed. I feel more grown up. Now, if anyone else out there wants to confess something, any sort of transgression against the liberal progressive agenda, their own heart, and you seek absolution or a liberal confessional, you can give us a call right now at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270, and confess your sins. So we'll be back with your confessions as we sit here and I cry. That's coming up next. You on Air America Radio.
Join the morning's edition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning's edition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
On the 90-day trial guarantee. Call 1-877-289-9200. That's 1-877-289-9200.
Seventeen past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hiya.
Morning's edition on Air America Radio. Chris Hedges in the wings. The book, Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America. Slightly deceiving title in that this is an honest assessment in a very personal way and in a very interesting look at the actual principles and ideas, spiritual ideas, within the Ten Commandments and how they don't necessarily need to be connected to religion to have an impact on the world and on individuals' lives. I found it a great read. I couldn't put it down. I'm looking forward to talking to Chris. Right now, we are taking your confessions at 866-303-2270. I guess we can begin that. I want to remind people that Morning's Edition will broadcast live this Friday from New York Strand Bookstore at the corner of Broadway and 12th Street from 6 to 9 a.m. We'll have playwright Eric Bogosian, New York City mayoral candidate C. Virginia Fields, and I believe comedian Jim David, who is also a columnist for The Advocate, will be there. They're giving tickets away, keychains, hats, maybe some mugs. Let's start some confessions. Scott, listening to S&M in Virginia. XM in Virginia. What is your sin, Scott?
Hey, Scott.
Bless me, Brother Mark and Riley.
Yeah. What's your sin, my son?
Yesterday, I had an opportunity to participate in a focus group concerning the Virginia mayor.
Mm-hmm.
Not mayor, governor, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
A little nervous.
Yeah, it's okay. Don't worry, my son.
And during the question session,
yeah,
they wanted to get our reactions, and they asked about, you know, various people, and one of them was Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
And first of all, it was all men between the ages of 25 and 40, I guess.
Yeah.
And they just tore every inch of hide off her.
Oh, my God.
And I just sat there and kept my mouth shut.
Oh, you experienced the fear and the horrendous outnumbering of Republican bloviators.
Yes.
Yeah. I understand your situation, but it is a heinous sin against everything that is progressive. But I understand that it is hard to stand up when they're sitting there going, but Clinton. So
really, I don't know what it is, but.
Oh, it's that's their hate Christ. That, you know, that is like the sort of barometer for which they judge everything bad about Democrats is through those Clintons. Obviously, it's not true, and I think your penance in this will definitely. It's going to take a couple years to enact, but you're going to have to work on Hillary's campaign. Shouldn't even be that big of a deal, really. I mean, I don't know how you feel exactly, but obviously you have, you're feeling some badness about not standing up for her. So when she runs for president, you're going to have to be the first on board there down in Virginia. Can you handle it?
I think I can.
There you go.
Are you disappointed with your penance, Scott?
Oh, no.
Okay,
easy,
but
actually.
All right, thanks, man. Take it easy. Yeah.
Well, you let him off easy, man. You got to make the next one tough.
Oh, boy. Sometimes it's hard to think of these. Katie, listening in the mic, on the mic in Madison, what's your sin, Katie?
Oh, my God. I just heard Mark say the next one's going to be tough. And you can't imagine how I need to say this out loud. On the other hand, I'm so ashamed I can hardly stand it.
Well, it's okay. We don't have your last name. So.
Yeah.
Well.
Yet.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, before, now, this truly was before it got as bad as it is. And I didn't, I have always, always hated Tom DeLay.
Mm-hmm.
However, there was a time when he came on the screen on television and I thought, oh, he's kind of cute.
Oh, my God.
Oh, I know.
Oh, my God.
I know, but I need to say that. Oh, God, I can't. I want to.
How long have you been carrying this with you? It's just horrendous.
Oh, God, it's been at least a year.
Oh, my God.
That's a sweet night.
Did you hear me? You are screwed up in the head.
It's good to say it out loud to you two.
Yes. No, I'm glad you're saying it, Katie. And I think that.
I don't think so anymore.
Well, I know, but you know, it was kind of stuck in the craw of your soul, and
it creeped you out. In other words,
yeah.
Well, it was kind of fourth grade in the first place, but
yeah, but it might be deeper than that. I mean, you know, he is a powerful evil man, and
yeah.
Sometimes there's nothing more sexy than power and evil.
Oh.
And bug killer.
Yeah, but but I would like to say that I think the only thing is I think you're going to have to get a couple of those sort of teen magazine fold-out pictures of Kucinich. And
that would be my pleasure. I like Dennis Kucinich.
But do you think he's cute?
Well, if it's true that people are cute because of who they are inside, then yes, I think he's adorable.
Okay, all right. Well, then it sounds like you're well on your way to engaging your penance. Is there anything more?
You know, why did I just this thing flash through my mind about somebody saying, "Well, he's got a great personality." I don't think you're real enthusiastic for Kucinich there.
I love his.
Politics. You love his politics.
Exactly.
You don't love his head, though, do you?
Well, I think you two are cute.
Okay.
Well,
that helps.
Yeah, that's why we stay on radio.
That's so funny.
That helps.
Yeah, because there's a point where I'm like, right when she said that, I'm like, okay, you're done. You're all good.
Tell us some more about how cute we are.
You've made it right. Thank you, Katie. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Katie.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Go to sleep, crazy.
What a nice voice. She had a nice
voice. Voice, yeah.
Who's that from, Chris? What is that go to, Chris?
That's Family Guy, my friend.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah, she's very pleasant. Wyatt, listening in Chicago. How are you, Wyatt?
What's up, Wyatt?
What's your sin, my friend?
I was confused when I was younger, and I voted for Republican judges in Texas.
Oh, my God.
Ooh.
This is just heinous.
That is heinous.
I feel like I've contributed to the whole mess we've got now with Bush's nominees.
Yeah, and I think you probably had something to do with some mentally challenged people being sent to the electric chair.
Yeah, right.
You know, I was confused. I was thinking to myself, they're going to be tough on crime. This is a good thing.
Yeah, whatever that.
Did you vote for Priscilla Owen? Was she one of the ones you voted for?
I don't even remember.
Well, I don't know.
I guess that's a saving grace.
I guess that part of your penance is maybe you should set up a neighborhood watch group in your neighborhood, and perhaps.
I got one for him.
Go ahead.
How about you go to the next time they get ready to execute somebody down in Huntsville, you go down there and you stand outside with a placard and protest the execution. How about that?
Well, I've actually moved to Illinois now. I kind of saw the
doesn't matter. Doesn't matter where you move.
You got a car.
You can move to Hudson Bay, Canada. You got to get down to Huntsville and protest executions.
Especially if it's somebody mentally challenged.
Yes, yeah. That one's going to be tough to get off your soul. Thanks for calling, Wyatt.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, buddy. Thank you for all your calls. And next time, you know, it's important that people get this stuff off their chest.
Yes, it is.
You know, and this definitely leads into our guest, Chris Hedges. Who I'm a big fan of. I'm looking forward to talking to him again. He's been on the show before. He wrote a book a couple of years ago called War is a Force that gives us meaning. And this new book, Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America, it's a very personal book where he really he takes on each commandment and filters it through his own heart and mind, but also he chooses stories to illustrate the significance in a very personal way and in a cultural way and in a spiritual way of the Ten Commandments, removed from religion.
See, that's the interesting part to me, Mark, mm-hmm. because most people do not remove the Ten Commandments. When they think about it, they don't remove the Ten Commandments from religion. The Ten Commandments in this country are inexorably linked to religion.
Well, he comes from a religious background, and he puts them into context in a religious way as well, but it's really how they apply to us and why they are what they are, which
yeah.
are the, you know, sort of the tenets or rules for maintaining, you know, civilized peoples. And, given that the Supreme Court is again deciding whether or not these religious symbols can be displayed
publicly,
which we'll talk to Chris a little bit about, I think it's definitely still a significant issue. But the interesting thing about this book is that he's not against the Ten Commandments in any way, and he's able to see, you know, through the heart of and he went to a divinity school. I mean,
he comes
from a religious family. So the way he weighs them, there's a chapter in here where he talks about honoring his father and also giving a speech at a commencement address shortly after the war began, an anti-war speech, and the kind of the reaction he got from the crowd, you know, the boo, get off, go home, you know, and how he dealt with that and how he stayed in with that and how he was able to see that as honoring his father. The stories that he uses to illustrate each commandment are unique.
Yeah.
And it's going to be interesting to get into that stuff with him. So Chris Hedges coming up next here on Air America Radio.
Listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Micah Marshall will fill us in on current events, plus an update from Baghdad on how things are going there. All next time on Franken.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Just a reminder, we'll be performing at this Friday from New York Strand Bookstore at the corner of Broadway and 12th Street from 6 to 9. We'll have playwright and actor Eric Bogosian and many other guests and free stuff and, the show.
Free thing.
The Strand Bookstore. Right now in studio, our guest, and I want to read this from his book before I introduce him from the last chapter of the book and summing up Losing Moses on the Freeway, the Ten Commandments in America, False Covenants, covenants built around exclusive communities of race, gender, class, religion, and nation inevitably carry within them the denigration of others who we exclude. These false covenants divide us. The covenant offered by the commandments, the covenant of life, is a covenant of love. It is a covenant that recognizes that all life is sacred and love is the force that makes life together possible. The author of this book, Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America, is Chris Hedges. He's with us. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Hi.
I tell you, it's where you walk in. I felt like I knew you because I read the book. I read your first book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and you really get to know a person because it's a very personal approach to the Ten Commandments. And I'd like you to, if you could, what inspired you to write a book honoring the Ten Commandments?
When I came back from overseas and landed in New York, they were showing a film at the Brooklyn Academy of Music called The Decalogue.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 10-part series that had been done by the Polish filmmaker Krzysztof Kieslowski, did Red, White, and Blue, the trilogy. And he filmed these narratives. They were fictional, based on one of the violations or one of the themes of the commandments.
Mm-hmm.
In such a thoughtful and refreshing way, freeing it from that clutter of piety and getting to these core issues that really make up the news, I think, of our lives in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, in his series, the woman, when he does Thou Shalt Not Commit Adultery, the woman's not even married. It's just a series of carnal relationships devoid of love.
Mm-hmm.
I went to seminary and I grew up in the church and stuff. But that had such a profound influence on me because I saw, the Bible has just sort of been taken and robbed or stolen by the Christian right,
yeah,
by these people who have turned it into a sort of a Sears, guide for living. I mean, it's for those of us who read the Bible, it's, of course, absolutely ridiculous. I mean, You can find just about anything you want in the Bible, from the justification of genocide to homophobia to, I mean, on and on and on. You know, these writers were not concerned with the process of creation or the process of living. They were concerned with the purpose of living, and struggling with, you know, how to deal with how to juxtapose the knowable universe against the unknowable God. And I think the commandments, and the other thing that's important to remember about the commandments is only two of them are actually incorporated into the legal code. Most of the violations that are dealt with the commandments, you know, dealing with your parents, envy, are violations that are deeply profound, but that are often outside the legal system, and that's why I found them so interesting and important.
In the first chapter, you deal with each chapter is a commandment except for the introduction and the final chapter. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. You tell the story of when you were, I guess, still in divinity school and went into Roxbury to oversee or to, what would you call it, to minister at a church there.
I ran a church in Howard.
And that was probably the most personal, that and the honor your parents, honor your father chapter were the most personal. So how in that first chapter, in the chapter titled Mystery, did you, it was almost like an existential crisis, it seemed.
Very much so, because I left the church.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I, you know, like many people who are in seminary or in the church, what I discovered by living for 2.5 years in the ghetto is that what I went to church to worship was my own virtue and my own goodness.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a realization of my own complicity, being a white middle-class guy in oppression, my first real understanding of systematic oppression, of the way institutions combine from banks to probation officers to schools to keep poor people poor, and how even though I lived in the ghetto and even though I worked in the ghetto, I was always going to be a symbol of the world that was denied to them. I think confronting that was and I think the other thing is the other crisis that I had was I always say that, you know, living in the ghetto for 2.5 years taught me to hate liberals. I had to commute into Harvard Divinity School, where everybody liked the poor, but they didn't like the smell of the poor. You know, they'd all go down to Nicaragua and pick coffee for a week. This was at the time of the Sandinistas, to sort of credentialize themselves as revolutionaries. But they'd never get on the Green Line and come over to a housing project where people were living in appalling conditions. We had a 60% vacancy rate, you know, rife with drugs and violence. All the doors on every single housing unit had been banged in, so there were no locks, which anybody who's ever lived in a project knows how frightening that is at night.
Yes.
It was the most important time in my life, and it was an existential crisis. It was, you know, I in many ways, I decided not to be ordained after that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the liberal mainstream church, while they still have that kind of self-righteousness for speaking for the oppressed, you know, for people they never meet, long ago abandoned the inner city in the same way that the Democratic Party abandoned the working class. And I think that hypocrisy is something that I saw up close, you know, leaving the projects, going to class at Cambridge, Massachusetts, at Harvard, and then coming back at night to the projects.
Chris, your book is obviously a very personal journey. And it strikes me that one thing we're seeing in the public arena with regard to religion is the depersonalization, at least in terms of you know, the Supreme Court's dealing with the public display of the Ten Commandments. So much of what we see from the religious right involves a public expression of religion. How important is this, you know, the idea of public? Because I'll tell you what, I consider myself a marginal person of faith, but I detest public displays of faith. For whatever reasons, my upbringing or whatever, that just drives me nuts.
Well, that's a good thing, because it's called idolatry. You know, what the Christian right offers up as religion is not religion. It's idolatry. It is civic religion. It is the fusion of national and religious symbols to create this form of self-worship, both of us as a nation and in many ways of us as individuals. And I think, you know, for those of us who've spent a long time reading the Bible, and certainly if there's one theme that runs through every single one of the Ten Commandments, it's that deep fear and loathing of idolatry. And that is, you know, look, you know, anything can become an idol. Religion can become an idol. The Bible can become an idol.
In the book, you actually use an example of a woman who follows Phish, the band.
Yeah.
Which is, the way it paced in the book, I mean, you know, you're dealing with some heavy stuff, but the book sort of goes in and out of personal stories that are very accessible. And when I started reading that, I was like, wow, this is the example he's going to use. But you were able to use it to great effect and also to get into some of the stuff that you're talking about.
Well,
here.
You know... you could pull anything. I mean, I could have pulled somebody who worked for the New York Times.
Right.
I mean, but what happens is people invest themselves in institutions or in groups. What I found interesting about Phish is that they all think they're rejecting that sort of world to create a new community. What they do is create, of course, a mirror reflection of the very world they're trying to flee. Because for Phish followers, it's all about recreating that ecstatic experience that they get at a concert, probably with the help of a few drugs and everything else, and going from city to city. I mean, I pulled the extreme Phish heads, you know,
all over the country.
How is that different from a consumer society? I think in many ways it's the same. So that the disease is still there.
The ecstatic experience is part of the propaganda and the device that these idolaters or the people that create the idols use. I mean, even in the megachurches that you read about, there are, you know, there's dry ice, there's music, there's rock bands, there's literally, you know, if you listen to the right song, if you have a song that moves you, it'll propel your endorphins into a spiral, and you will have an ecstatic experience that has nothing to do with the personal confrontation of the unknowable God, which you talk about. And myself being, you know, pretty agnostic, you talk about how you define God is very interesting. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I mean, you know, Martin Luther wrote, you know, everybody has a God. It just depends which one you want. You know, it's Tillich's, Paul Tillich's term, theologian Paul Tillich, that God is whatever your ultimate concern is. Whatever the most important thing to you in your life is, what you get most passionate about, what you obsess about most, becomes your God.
Mm-hmm.
And Augustine wrote in City of God that there are only two forms of worship. There's the worship of self-worship, and the worship of God. And that I think, is a really important point, because you may worship the institution you work for, you may worship power, you may worship money, you may worship your own virtue, whatever it is. But it becomes self-worship in the end, because it's about the exaltation and promotion of the self above all else, and often above everyone else. And I think that's true. I think ultimately that is the divide between whether we choose to worship self or we choose to worship God or worship mystery. I mean, God is, of course, unknowable And in that, and I think this is what the commandments are a call to.
Yeah.
It's you know, if you really look at the commandments, there's a kind of radicalness that pulls us away from the demands of American society, and it's a call for self-sacrifice for the other, ultimately. When you really read through what they are, is calling you to deny often your own impulses and your own desires for the benefit of the other.
Okay, when coming up, we're going to continue this conversation. I want to talk a little bit about the difference between killing and murder, and the chapter on murder, and the use of the Vietnam vet that you talked to. That is now is he a bishop? That was some very profound, deep stuff. And we'll continue this conversation with Chris Hedges here on Air America coming up next.
Hi, this is Terry Jones from Monty Python, and you're listening to Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Morning Sedition. They're not the Messiah, they're very naughty boys on Air America Radio.
800-357-1473. 800-357-1473. That's 800-357-1473.
Fifty past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. In studio, the author of Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America, a great guest who we've had on the show before, Chris Hedges, is with us. We're talking about the book, a very personal book, a very profound book. I mean, mine's all underlined already, Chris. It's become a seminal text in the Marin Library. It's underlined. Let's talk about the chapter, each chapter, of course, representing a commandment. The murder chapter, You Shall Not Kill, is focused around Bishop George Packard. Could you give us a little bit of history about him and his struggle?
He was a platoon leader in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and his job basically was to set up ambushes, often night ambushes, for Viet Cong or North Vietnamese. And it very quickly became apparent that if they were going to survive, once the ambush was finished, they had to murder or kill all the wounded. And he actually describes at one point some wounded Viet Cong with the legs blown off crawling at him and him throwing an area grenade at this guy to kill him. He became quite a proficient professional killer,
mm-hmm.
And something that he, in retrospect, admits that he was proud of doing. He won the Silver Star at the end of the war. He actually trained Rangers in ambushes. But when he came back, he suffered, as many veterans do, from the consequences of what it was he had been set out to do.
In the chapter, though, it's interesting because you say initially he didn't have a problem of conscience because he believed that it was his duty to kill.
Yeah, he believed that it was duty and he took pride in his ability to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I found him a remarkable man in many ways, partly because of his brutal honesty.
Yeah.
And there's a quote in there that says, "Let's not mince words," or something like that. I violated the commandment. I killed. And I think that when you, having covered irregular warfare, certainly this would apply to the war in Iraq, there's far more murder going on or than there is killing. Is killing, if we define killing as the killing of somebody who's trying to harm you and has the capacity to harm you with another weapon.
Right.
Murder is the killing of somebody who's defenseless. But in counterinsurgency warfare, where everything is a huge blur, you're fighting in urban centers, there are no fixed lines, murder very quickly begins to predominate, as it did in Vietnam, as it is in Iraq. And those soldiers, Marines that come back and have the moral courage to face that have to struggle deeply with their complicity in the deaths of innocents. I think the other thing that Packard and many veterans, and I think we are going to see this again with people coming, these men and women coming back from Iraq, is they see the lie of the civil religion. They go to a place like Iraq or Vietnam, and they understand that we are not a good and moral and righteous nation, that God is not always on our side, that we have a capacity, like all human beings, to commit atrocious acts of barbarism,
mm-hmm.
Indeed find a kind of intoxicating thrill of it. I mean, the pictures that we saw from Abu Ghraib are not an aberration. Those are the real. That is the real face of war.
And so what you're saying is, in essence, and with this whole book, we got a phone call I want to take for you in just a second, is that the commandments are what it regulates our behavior in the sense of right and wrong in the face of these natural instincts that can get way out of control.
That's exactly it. I think that the commandment deals with the impulses. You know, we can't protect ourselves. I mean, commandments choose us. We don't choose them in many cases. Whether it's adultery, whether it's theft, whether it's greed, whether it's murder, whatever it is, with our relationship with our parents. These are oftentimes forces beyond our control. And that's the power of the commandments. They deal with the severest violations human beings suffer.
We have Brooke Packard is on the phone, the wife of Bishop George Packard. Good morning, Mrs. Packard. How are you?
Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Yeah. I basically called to ask if I could podcast the show so my husband could hear it. And just to say to Chris, just we respect his work so much, and this, you know, I'm so glad that there's a voice out there for believers who are more thinking in depth and more sincerely about their faith than what we see out there. But and I don't want to steal thunder from my husband because he's just a great guy and Chris is a great, profound writer. But one of the things that Chris wrote that after the article, we got, you know, all these phone calls with people saying, the picture you published, George, looks so sad. You know, it just looked like and people, you know, kept calling and going, don't be sad. There's a differentiation between murder and kill. But the real thing is, he, you know, Chris put it very articulately. There's something irrevocably changed internally when you engage in the killing, whether it's justified or not.
Mm-hmm.
So that I thought you might want to touch on.
Okay, well, thanks for your call. Thank you so much for calling. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you. There are many voices out there, including Brooke and Bishop Packard. I mean, unfortunately, those voices often aren't heard in a way that they should. I think they represent the majority of people of faith, if you want to define us that way. Yes, there is something that irrevocably changes, and it's something that you struggle with for the rest of your life. I mean, I had a Vietnam vet tell me, you know, the worst thing about being a vet is that you know you'll never sleep well again for the rest of your life. And I think that, what the state asks us to do, asks its young people to do, asks what it's asking them to do currently in Iraq, is something that will leave emotional and psychological scars of tremendous weight for them to carry for the rest of their lives. And sadly, when these people come back and try and tell us the truth, really about ourselves, come back, I think, in many ways as prophets,
mm-hmm.
to tell us about us as a people and us as a nation, we don't want to hear. We prefer the myth. We prefer the big band playing and the martial music and glory and all the stuff that the, 30 seconds of combat exposes as a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And we oftentimes ignore the very people who we've sent to sacrifice and who have something to tell us profoundly about ourselves, and I think we need to start listening to those voices, especially now.
Well, I tell you, it moved me, and I'm not by nature a believer. The book is Losing Moses on the Freeway. Chris Hedges, I really appreciate you coming back and talking to us.
Thanks, Chris.
Very compelling, and it is a great book. And it will put a lot of things into context. It damn near made a believer out of me. It might have. Coming up next, we'll talk to a lactivist.
Yes.
So. Jews. What is that? 6 past the hour.
Free golf.
Morning tradition here on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Oh, no, you know.
And that's Kayla playing with buttons.
I used to love the fat guys.
What's that?
The fat man made a funny.
I used to love the fat guys.
Jews.
Free golf.
Anyways. Mornings, you feel a little better, Kayla?
A little bit.
Lord, yeah, I'm glad. It's nice to see you laugh, man. You've been festering about this dental surgery too long. But that's a horrible experience to have, Mark Riley, when someone walks in and goes, guess what? I'm getting my teeth fixed for a nickel after Chris spent like $2,000 on his teeth.
Yeah, it's not like you can go back to the dentist and say, hey, wait a minute, I want my discount.
Yeah, on the same health plan. Well, you're going to have to go back. You're going to have to file a claim and find out what the hell went wrong, Chris.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll work out.
It will. It can. It does. It can work out. Sometimes you'd be surprised. It's only a matter of not doing the paperwork. Sometimes if you just do the paperwork, you can get what you need. But maybe I'm being optimistic. Look, Morning's Edition will broadcast live this Friday from New York's Strand Bookstore at the corner of Broadway and 12th Street from 6 to 9 a.m. We'll have playwright and actor Eric Bogosian, New York City Mayoral?
There you go.
Candidate C, Virginia Fields, joining us. Plus, we'll be giving away tons of free stuff, including a raffle for 2 tickets. Dig this. I wish we had a drum roll. Do I? Yes.
There you go.
We're going to give away 2 tickets to see me do stand-up in New Jersey at Bananas Comedy Club in Hasbrook Heights. That's on June 25th.
With that snare drum and that cymbal.
Yes. Just me and the snare drum and the cymbal. Hey, folks, look. It's not going to happen for the United States and the Olympics. It's not going to happen, and it's not going to happen in terms of a West Side Stadium in New York City, which I'm happy about. I think a lot of people are relieved about. You've been calling it, Riley. You've been saying this for weeks. Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver might have gotten his way here, but there's definitely not going to be any Olympics or stadium in the near future here in New York City.
No. There was a trade-off that the city was not prepared to make in terms of the amount of office space by the stadium and the amount of office space at Ground Zero. Now, some people outside of New York may ask themselves, well, why would there be some kind of wacky competition between the west side of one city and the south side of the same city? Why would there be all this conflict and arguing and back and forth about that? Well, you haven't visited New York. That's what this place is all about.
Well, I think it seems to me that, you know, in looking at the big picture of politics, it's like that on all levels. A lot of people just think, and naively so, and I was naive as well, it's like, why don't they just do something for the people? Why don't they just do something that's right? It's because you have all these combating legislators, you have combating interests, you have combating departments within any city government or national government. It's mind-blowing just how little it is about what the people want.
Well, you know, it's funny because one of the reasons why New York is not at the top of the list of the International Olympic Committee, in addition to not having the stadium, is that they didn't detect a great deal of public support for bringing the Olympics here. That was one of the problems that London had a year ago and that they've been working on for the past year. The mayor, if there's one great failing in his whole proposal about the Olympics, is that it didn't get people enthusiastic about it.
Well, that's right. So that it wasn't the public's fault necessarily. It was that it wasn't even presented to them as an exciting option.
Oh, no.
And I think on another level, New Yorkers would have been like, are you kidding me? The Olympics?
We just had the convention.
What
I got to wait 15 minutes on 34th Street again?
We just had the convention, exactly. What else do we need? Come on.
We're New Yorkies.
Yeah. So here's the sad thing. One sad thing is that I don't know where my priority mail envelope is, and it's been a week and a half that my wife sent, but not as sad as for perhaps some of the 3.9 million people whose data and records, I mean records including banking records, address, social security numbers, were lost in a box of computer tapes. These are City Financial, the consumer finance subsidiary of Citigroup, mailed this to Texas to be data logged or something, and they disappear, Riley. In this age of identity theft, this is scary stuff to me.
It is scary stuff because what it means is somebody may be walking around with data, including, by the way, the credit histories of almost 4 million people, and they could use those histories to begin to create phantom identities, to create phantom credit. They can do virtually anything with it, and they haven't been able to find where the box went. It could be in a dumpster someplace, or it could be in some organized crime guy's
house.
That's
what I think. I think it was an inside job. I think somebody took a payoff. I think somebody knew what was going on. I mean, that's maybe I'm not saying this is, you know, true, but I suspect it.
No, you know what? This could be a high-tech Brinks job.
Yeah, how high-tech? It's just a lost mail. What would it take as a UPS guy? Yeah, here's $100. Thank you. See ya.
Brown do for you?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, you work for the post office. I mean, it's not like, you know, these places are...
Marginally.
It's not like these places are high-security events, you know. I mean, they have tracking codes, but it really comes down to a guy in a truck, and I've seen that guy get off that truck and go in to put the box in the place.
Oh, well, yeah.
You can get right on the truck if you want to get on the truck.
You know why
take
they
it
got
for a spin? I did that once. No, I'm kidding. No.
No, you know why? You know why this happened? Because there are two different ways to do the pickups of these boxes.
Yeah.
One, you can scan each box individually, or you can scan something on a piece of paper that supposedly deals with everything that you have. Well, the driver in this case did the latter when he should have done the former, so therefore they have no scan or tracking of that particular box.
Mm.
All they know is it was supposed to go from Weehawken to Texas. And by the way, it was going to a credit reporting agency.
Really?
Yeah, experience.
So, but I mean, it's I don't know who's on and who. It seemed to have been lost in transit.
Yeah.
Here's a weird story. This company, Scandinavian Cryobank, that's been in business in Denmark for about 20 years, basically, and it basically sells the sperm of Scandinavian guys to anybody who wants it. You know, blonde hair, blue eyes, tall, Viking sperm, Aryan sperm that you can get for relatively cheap. I was surprised that, you know, this.
$2.50 a lot, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for a straw.
A straw full of sperm.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what that. I don't know what that really looks like. I'm thinking it looks like one of those. You know, the honey sticks. You know, the honey comes in. It must be something like that. But
I got a plan for this.
Yeah,
I got a plan.
Yeah,
I want infertile black women to start patronizing this Scandinavian Viking sperm bank. Yeah.
Why do you think I married a 6-foot-tall woman of Germanic background specifically for this reason? Yeah.
Really?
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm gonna have a large, you know, tall, Aryan-looking son. I'm gonna name him Thor. And
He will catch lightning in his hands.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Thor, yeah. And I guess because of my personal legacy in terms of where I come from, of a sort of Semitic insecurity, he will probably not have a lot of self-esteem. But he'll be, you know, be an attractive kid. I think the big problem with this thing is that not everybody, just because you get the sperm of a genius or you get the sperm of Hercules, doesn't mean that's the kid you're going to get. If you get the sperm of a track star, the kid could come out, you know, just not wanting to do sports at all. And I just think the expectations, it's already bad enough that parents are disappointed with their kids when they don't act properly or how they think they should act without having this. But can you imagine you're 10 years old, 15 years old, and you're supposed to be a genius because the sperm you bought for $500 was Albert Einstein's frozen sperm, and the kid turns out to be, you know, a grill cook? I mean, what are you going to put that kid through? Like, well, I don't got, what a jip.
Well, maybe he's a kid that invented George Foreman grill.
Well, that'd be genius. But what if he didn't do anything? The pressure you're going to put on that kid, it's like, I don't understand. How'd we get the dud sperm?
You know, I think sometimes, Mark, these things have a tendency to, like, skip generations. So it may not be that kid, but it'll be the person that bought the sperm's grandkid that turns out to be the genius.
Well, I want to get on the phone a woman that we talked to yesterday, Caridwyn Morris from thenewmom.com. She was one of the lactivists who went down to ABC Studios with a bunch of other breastfeeding mothers to protest Barbara Walters and Star Jones's comments about how they were uncomfortable with breastfeeding in public. They thought it was gross and disgusting. Caridwyn, good morning. How'd the big protest go?
Hi.
Oh, hi, guys. It was great. First of all, I just want to say that I love listening to you guys talk about breastfeeding. I mean, when do you hear a couple of guys on morning radio just talking about breastfeeding for a couple of times?
Over and over again.
We like it, in case you didn't know.
Oh, my God, it was great. So, anyway, there was a really big turnout. I'd say there was probably about over 100 moms.
Really? The New York Times said 200.
Did they really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay, so maybe...
always over-report, Caridwyn.
Okay, yeah. I've got to start over-reporting.
Now,
200 including the babies? It's hard for me to tell.
There you go. That was good. That was a good spin there. Let's just say 300, 600, 900 people showed up.
900 people showed up. There were police barricades. It was that big.
So there was 200 women and, I guess, 400 boobs. And how many of the boobs were out?
Everyone brought a boob out at some point in the nursing.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I mean, there was one guy who was filming, for a minute we were a little...
Ugly George?
The guy with the camera for the wrong reason.
Huh? Yeah.
Right. But it turned out he was the father of a new little baby. And so we're going to get some of his footage and put it on our website, so that should be a good way for people to see what was going on. It was very fun. It was a very laid-back group, because when women breastfeed...
You're going to have to start charging an access fee to your website.
Yeah, exactly.
When women what?
No, when women breastfeed, these really great hormones are released that are basically natural opiates. So there's a very kind of mellow kind of thing going on with all these women, even though the event has been reported as, you know, a bunch of angry women getting together. It was definitely political, but it was also, you know, a pretty relaxed kind of scene.
Well, I'm glad it worked out. What's up, Ryan?
No, I just want, how were the cops?
The cops were great. They were we were all talking with them. They were like, that's interesting. But I wonder what the other women said. And it was kind of crazy because we're all sort of trying to figure out what was said on The View. And
one cop was probably like, can I get 3 years over here just talking to me at the same time?
So I guess, I mean, there was some press coverage.
It sounds like it went well.
Daily News. I guess there were a couple of local news outfits there last night.
All right, well, let me plug your website, and then we got to move on. Thenewmom.com is Caridwyn and her partner Rebecca's website, where they're compiling stuff about pregnancy, birth, experiences of new mothers in order to put together a very well-rounded book for new moms. Is that right?
That's right. And a lot of your listeners went to our site yesterday because we got some really, really great, smart, articulate, political stories.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for talking to us, Caridwyn.
Okay, thanks.
See you later.
Bye.
Caridwyn Morris with thenewmom.com. Go check that out and share your experiences. We're going to have Lawton Smalls coming up. And also, John Harris is going to be in studio. He's the author of The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House, a little later. So stay with us here on Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
866-800-957-6066, 800-957-6066. Not available in all states.
22 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. We'll be broadcasting live this Friday from New York Strand Bookstore at the corner of Broadway and 12th Street. We'll have Eric Bogosian with us. Mayoral candidate C. Virginia Field. Comedian Jim David. He's also a columnist for The Advocate. Funny Southern man. We're giving away some stuff, including two tickets to see me in New Jersey on June 25th at Bananas in Hasbrook, New Jersey. Right now, since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. So now on the phone once again is Planet Push Bureau Chief Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Hey, good morning, Mark. It was good meeting you Friday. Thought you'd be taller, though.
Okay, yeah.
At least you shaved.
All right, let me read you something,
my
friend. Okay, here's what Dick Cheney said about the Iraqi insurgents.
Dick Cheney.
Yes, listen to this. It's about the insurgents, Lawton.
Yep.
The level of activity that we see today from a military standpoint, I think, will clearly decline. I think they're in the last throes of the insurgency. Wow, come on.
Well,
come
on. And you were going to second-guess this administration. I guess you feel pretty stupid, don't you?
Oh, come on, stupid. What are you talking about? The last throes of the insurgency. Now, that's stupid.
Mark, the rats are headed for the hills, buddy. They're packing their tents. The circus is over. They've been abandoned by their ten-horned Muslim god.
Oh.
We shocking on them right on out of there. Or as Toby Keith likes to say, shocking y'all.
Oh, not Toby Keith.
Shocking
what
y'all.
What is Shane even basing this on? It's completely nuts. He's got no proof on it.
His years of military service?
What are you talking about?
Vice President Dick, two-terms mandate Cheney's been in combat for so long.
What?
You can't really dispute his opinion on a deal like this.
Oh,
he was just over there in Fallujah in a tank last week.
Yeah.
Okay. Death in the eye.
What are you, crazy?
Every day.
What about this? Last month alone, car bombings and other attacks killed 80 U.S. soldiers and more than 800 Iraqis, Lawton.
800, huh?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that sounds about right.
What do you mean that sounds about right?
Well, isn't it obvious, Mark? Those are the kind of numbers you get just before the other fella calls it a day.
Oh, that's crazy.
There's 5 seconds left in the game. The insurgents are throwing up a Hail Mary pass.
Oh.
But since they're Muslims, the Virgin Mary's not going to give them that touchdown they need to win. Game over. Tear down the goalposts.
No, buddy, listen to this. Listen to this, Watton. Senator Joe Biden met with military commanders recently and afterwards said, quote,
mercy.
The idea that the insurgents are on the run and we're about to turn the corner, I did not hear that from anybody, end quote. What about that, huh? That's Senator Biden.
Mark, and what party does Senator Biden belong to?
He's a Democrat.
Thank you. That means the please disregard life is now lit.
Oh, come on.
Your
come
left-wing
on,
attack
on.
Machine's out of gas today, buddy.
Come on.
I run the Texaco station.
Oh, you know what? I'm tired of it. I'm tired of your misinformation. Biden also says that the U.S. is at least two years away from viable Iraqi military. And it is no longer reasonable to consider boosting U.S. troops who are already strained after 2 years in Iraq. That's a quagmire line. I'm sorry to tell you. It's quagmire.
Last throws.
Dude, Bush and Cheney just keep lying because they know they failed, Lawton. They've made wrong moves step of the way in this war, and now we're all paying for it. The insurgents aren't going away, and they're getting stronger. If anything, we're in the last throes of Bush, my friend, of Bush. And I'm not pro-insurgents, but come on, wake up. What's the matter?
I once saw baby Buddy get hit by a car.
Oh, boy.
It wasn't quite dead. It was just laying there bleeding on the pavement with his little pink nose twitching and his little fluffy tail quivering. Died in my arms.
Oh.
That's what last throws look like.
Oh, my God.
That Buddy couldn't blow up no car.
What's
that's for damn sure.
What's the matter with you?
Dick Cheney took my rabbit.
Oh, my God. It's awful. Just take it easy, man. Would you, man, the bunny thing? Would you please? Please, Ryan. Oh, jeez. Yeah. You all right there? Wow.
Last one out of Iraq. Turn off the lights. That lady's singing, and it sounds like Patsy.
All right, great. Goodbye.
I'm going to see you Friday.
Goodbye, Ryan. You coming down the Strand?
I'm coming.
All right, man.
Get ready for that. God loves you. Deal with it.
All right, I'll try. Yeah. A lot of God on the show. I'm going to be a believer by the end of this episode.
I don't know.
So this is exciting. We've got John Harris, the author of The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House. He's going to be here in the studio. This book is getting a lot of interesting response from both sides. You know, the Republicans are trying to use it for their spin. The Democrats are using it in their own way. And neither side is quite happy with the book, per se, in terms of the information there. So we can address this with John Harris in person. He will be in here momentarily. So that's John Harris coming up next here on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Term. Oh, my God.
Randy Rose on Air America Radio.
I'm not interested in his character. I want to change the character of the presidency.
If you talk to any moronic Republican who gets his talking points from Hannity or Rush Limbaugh, and you make any logical argument about delay, they'll go, but Clinton, that's all they can do.
I think we all agree that we have to change the way the government works.
How many times can Republicans say, but Clinton, before you say, shut up? It's got nothing to do with Clinton, you moron.
Now it is time, in fact, it is past time to move on. We have important work to do. Real opportunities to seize. Real problems to solve.
I mean, you got to stop that, people. If you want to have a conversation with a Republican, as soon as he goes, but Clinton, just tell him, you know what? The conversation's over because that's old news and it makes no difference. But shut up.
I feel your pain.
35 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. It's Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. That was a surprise montage. Thanks, fellas. Hadn't heard that one. The book, The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House, comes out today. It's available on our website. It's been out about a week, actually, but you can get it at morningsedition.com. We are pleased to have in our studio the author of that book, John Harris. He's a political correspondent for The Washington Post. And this is your new book. And what was it like to cover Bill Clinton?
You know, it was a terrific ride. I've been around these guys for about a decade. I started covering him really at a low point in Bill Clinton's presidency, lower even than he ever was during Lewinsky. This was January 95. Newt Gingrich and the Republicans had just taken over. Bill Clinton was a beaten man, and that I watched him through, you know, there would be numerous comebacks still to come, but that perhaps that first one was the most impressive in 95 when he was counted completely down and out in January. By December of that year, it became obvious he was going to waltz to reelection.
How did you characterize that comeback? What are the qualities of Bill Clinton that that were working sort of in harmony to make that political resurrection possible?
Couple of things. First, at the most elemental level, hunger. I think that is, you know, occasionally what gets Bill Clinton into trouble, those expansive appetites, to sort of put it mildly. But it's also what carries him out of trouble. Mm-hmm. The guy just, at some basic constitutional level, refuses to be beaten. And then, you know, I think you also have to point out his head. He's a smart guy, and he figured out what he needed to do.
Now, you talk in the book a bit about Bill Clinton's feelings about his wife, Senator Clinton, possibly running for the presidency. Do you really think he wants her to see her president?
I think he's a very mixed minds on this, but probably on balance, yes, he does. It's a genuine partnership. The right never accepts this. They think it's a convenience or a show. I simply don't believe that. It's the real thing. I think if she were to be elected president, that's a huge validation of his presidency and really makes the Clintons not just sort of an asterisk in the 90s, but you know, they're dominating two and possibly three decades. I think he'd like that. On the other hand, I think he's enjoying his life right now, flying around the world. He'd have to lower his profile a bit to let her run for president. And, you know, just to be blunt, he'd have to be on best behavior in every dimension of his life.
Wait. Does that mean that maybe you don't think he has been on his best behavior since he left the White House?
All I'm saying is he'd have to be on his best behavior in every dimension of his life.
Let's talk about a little bit about what he's doing now. Do you think that this effort, this sort of international goodwill effort on behalf of Clinton is an attempt to sort of, you know, redefine his legacy, to stay in the limelight in a way that hopefully will guarantee him a respectable place in the minds of everybody?
Yeah, you know, it's probably that, but I think we have to also take it on the level. He's doing a lot of pretty good things. He's got an effort on AIDS treatment in the third world. Hundreds of thousands of people getting treatment at reduced drugs, so that's pretty good. You know, who cares what the motives are?
I was furious myself about his alignment with George Senior. Just, I mean, I literally, you know, he said that, you know, he could feel other people's pain, but you know, when he reached out to George Senior, and I got to, you know, witness, you know, George Junior just seeing this event, I for some reason, maybe I was projecting, but I was like, God, what is he doing? Why would he align himself with these people that beat the hell out of him for years?
Yeah, I know what you mean, and I think there's a really good point in that. He is never going to be, Bill Clinton is never going to be a pure Democrat. And remember, during the presidency itself, often liberals were furious with him over welfare reform, over, I could list off a dozen things. So it's kind of odd that he's now a Democratic hero, but I have to always remember, you know, yes, but.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right after September 11th, Bill Clinton, unannounced, came down to the place where they were doing all the identification of the bodies and that sort of thing. And I mean, it was extraordinary to watch how he made person-to-person contact with some of the people that were trying to find out information. They didn't know whether their relatives were alive or dead at that point. And that person-to-person contact seemed to have served him very well in the White House. How does he use it now?
Look, it's no surprise to you guys that America's role in the world is a hugely controversial subject right now. And if you were to take an election around the world, it would be overwhelming. I don't say this from a partisan point of view, just as a fact. It would be overwhelming against George W. Bush. Bill Clinton represents to the rest of the country, I mean the rest of the world, a more benign view of America and America's role in the world. And some of that is precisely what you're talking about, Mark. That ability to understand people at a human level. And part of it also is frankly ideological. People in a lot of countries don't like what they perceive as the unilateralism and arrogance of the Bush administration and think Clinton represented a better approach.
Isn't there a section in the book where you talk about where he's encouraging, who is it, Rubin, to go out and you know, talk to regular people?
Yeah, this is a funny scene that every Thanksgiving he'd say to his team, now let's go out, use the holiday, go out and talk to real people. And, you know, Bob Rubin would be kind of offended by this. Am I a real person? And Clinton said, no, Bob, you're not. You weren't before, and you're even less of one now.
Now, the book is taking a little flack from the left for not, you know, I guess, celebrating a little more some of the stuff that Clinton had done in response to terrorism, in response to North Korea, and then the right is picking it apart to find the parts where that make him look vulnerable or you know, sort of define what their image is of him. How do you respond to this? Do you think that you put together a book that is objective? Did you overlook certain things for a reason?
Look, my aim was to write a book that would say, tell people what it was like. I wanted both intimacy, taking people behind the scenes to decisions, mm-hmm. and also detachment.
Mm-hmm.
5 years have passed, now we can make a judgment on this. It wasn't from an ideological point of view, and I think that's an asset of the book,
mm-hmm.
that people on the right will look at Bill Clinton and have to acknowledge that he did some things well. People on the left will look at it and have to acknowledge he squandered some opportunities.
You know, 5 years ago, I was out at the Democratic convention when Bill Clinton was introduced at the beginning of the convention on purpose because they didn't want to take away from Al Gore. And, you know, the Democrats that were there then looked at this guy like he was a rock star. You know, they started out with the whole video of him being down in the bowels of the Staples
right,
Center.
It was
and
like,
he comes
yeah.
out. And it's, I mean, it was like Jimi Hendrix had been reincarnated or something. But how much longer do you think Bill Clinton will be, because we've had two Democrats who have lost since him, how long do you think he will be the Democratic Party's template?
I think for at least the next 4 years. I think there's no doubt in my mind, frankly, that Hillary Clinton will run for president in 2008.
Will she win?
I think people that say she could never win haven't looked at the evidence of her record. She won in New York State, here in the city, of course. But look, I'm from upstate New York and Rochester. That's not a Democratic territory. Tends to be Republican. She ran very competitively up there. So she has proven that she can take the Clinton formula, even as polarizing and divisive as she is, and reach those sort of moderate swing voters in New York. I think it's reasonable she might be able to do that nationally.
Wow, that's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
And you certainly have had enough contact with these two to know that. I heard it here first. We're going to see if you're right. John Harris, the book is A Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House. Now, what have you been your encounters with him? Have you met him? Have you talked to him? Has he made any comments to you?
Look, I've had, a dozen or more interviews over the years that I've been covering Bill Clinton. He didn't give an interview for this book. He felt that he was contractually prohibited because of his own book.
That probably said, I don't want you competing with me. I got a book out on me.
He got a bigger advance than I do. I can assure you that. But I've seen him since the book has come out. We chit-chatted inconsequentially and not about the book. Classic Bill Clinton. Always takes the subject to something sort of non-threatening.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we talked about his weight. We talked about his travel. We talked about everything except the kind of...
How does that unfold with him? Does he say, hey, John, how do I look?
You know, I don't even remember how it came up. He looked
my
pretty
look
good,
fat?
I thought. No, he looked, he's lost a lot of weight. He said he put on 5 pounds, but he looked good to me. He's a lot lighter than he was as president.
Does he have an eating disorder, John?
I think so. He might have some excessive appetite, but he's got them apparently under control.
Well, that's good.
Why do you think it is that Bill Clinton, throughout his presidency and even after, has had this ability to embrace people who are perceived as his enemies?
It's just the nature of his personality from a boy. He does not... all things being equal, he prefers not to have confrontation. So there's a paradox that we have to wrestle with. Why was this person who wanted to get along, who, if anything, wanted to be almost too nice to his enemies, why was he so such a divisive and controversial figure? That's a complicated subject. You're quite right. That's the nature of Bill Clinton's personality. Not, I might point out, the nature of Hillary Clinton's personality,
yeah,
who is much more oriented toward black and white, good guys, bad guys, and an approach to politics as conflict.
So her need for love is different.
Yeah, I mean, she's just a much more disciplined and buttoned-down figure. I think she's a very effective politician, but her sort of temperamental makeup is much, much different than his.
Well, the book is The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House. John F. Harris, a national correspondent for The Washington Post, thank you for being with us. Good luck with the book. I'm looking forward to finishing it. I was skimming it, and hope to learn something I didn't know about Bill Clinton.
I hope you do. I hope readers do. Thank you so much. A real
Thanks
treat
so
to be with you.
Okay, we'll continue this show as we move on. We're going to have the Cliff Notes coming up and wrap up today's story coming up next here on Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
That's cabinet refacing from Sears Home Services, 1-800-828-1200. That's 1-800-828-1200.
All right, we're going to put this thing down. It's 50 past the hour. Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Yes.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Now, I'm festering about this damn package. You know, it's not going to show up. It's a United States Postal Service. It's a priority mail package. It was sent the day before Memorial Day. I don't know what happened to that. But now, I read this story. Of course, this makes me more paranoid. But this is UPS, United Parcel Service,
mm-hmm,
which apparently 3.9 million people have now lost their identities in a box. One box, Riley. There's a box with computer tapes in it with 3.9 million people's social security numbers, their names, their addresses, their bank accounts. This was lost by Citi Financial, the consumer finance subsidiary of Citigroup. And no one knows where it is. It was on its way to Texas to be logged into something. Wait, it doesn't even matter.
Into the big database in the
sky. So, but I think it's a inside job. I think somebody got it. I think that this is all part of it. I don't even know how to protect myself from identity theft half the time. I got a shredder. You got to change your password. You got to make sure you don't run away announcing your social security number in public, which some people do. They're just like, hey, 744.
Hey, one of the things that's different about this identity theft situation, in this case,
right,
the stuff being lost,
mm-hmm,
at least the CEO of UPS stood up and said, hey, we made the mistake. It was our fault.
Yeah, and they're offering some people protection. They're offering some people 90 days or up to a year of credit protection or whatever they're offering. But that doesn't make it any different. If this is a criminal thing, I mean, the repercussions of this can be baffling, can be mind-blowing, how easy it is for people to open up bank accounts, to get loans, to buy things with your personal information.
Inside job, huh?
I don't know. Maybe, I mean, that's my paranoia. I just assume that. Like, what would it take? I mean, like I was saying, you see these guys get off the truck. They get on the truck. I'm not saying that one of the guys who works for UPS is corrupt, but who the hell knows?
I think you may be right. I mean, look, they know where this stuff is coming from if they don't know where it's going to.
P.W. McDonald, our producer here, used to work on a truck, and he said it'd be easy. Those guys get off the truck all the time. I'm not knocking them. But, I mean, in my head, it would seem that somebody would have to know or would have had to got a call from the inside over at City Financial or somebody who in cahoots. But this is
think they're holding the names hostage or something?
Well, why would they hold them hostage if they could sell them for $1 million?
Well, maybe that's what it is. They're holding for ransom.
Yeah, that's possible.
You know?
They're kidnapped a box of names.
Yep.
A kidnap a box of numbers.
And credit histories and Social Security
numbers. That is your identity. It's like your DNA. It's like your, what would you call it? Your I don't know, something DNA.
I'm going to go find a cabin someplace.
No joke came to me. I hate when that happens. Well, you know I'm about to do something and it doesn't happen. And it's not because I'm high, because I don't do that anymore. I haven't done it for years.
But,
wait a minute. You're saying it has something to do with...
Oh, here we go. I'm moving out of the way.
It has something to do with me being a Jew?
Possibly.
Frigom?
I used to love the fat guy.
Why is it got to be about me being a Jew all of a sudden, Chris? I mean, just because you're upset about a little financial problem, just because apparently you went to the sucker dentist recommended by the insurance company.
The same dentist.
Yeah,
Brendan.
You mean the guy that Brendan McDonald is paying $10 a tooth for charged you $800 for two teeth?
Well... No, he went to a different referral than I did.
Oh, well, maybe that's the problem.
I don't know, man.
Maybe.
Who is your daddy, and what does he do?
So what is your basic problem? So this has ruined your whole day because, what, you're incapable of being an adult about something and not, you know, being able to...
He don't like getting beat. That's all that is. He got beat.
I'm sorry, Chris. Maybe we should get one of the lactivists in here to help you out. Maybe that could turn your day around a little bit.
I have no button to respond.
Don't make me kick your neck.
All right. I think it's going to work out for you, though. I really do.
Yeah.
You want to bet on it?
Sure. I'll bet you.
History's worst luck.
Let me just tell you something. This doesn't have to do with luck, and I will bet on it. If you and Brendan are covered by the plan that is available to Air America employees, and you have the exact same problem, and Brendan has been referred to a dentist or whatever is going on that will enable him to pay $10 a tooth to get them surgically extracted from his head, and you had the exact same procedure done and paid $800 for how many teeth?
Four. Actually, $1,600 for four teeth.
$1,600 for four teeth, that's $400 a tooth. That is a savings of $390 you could have if you fill out some paperwork. I will bet you... I'll bet you $10. I'll bet you the cost of one of Brendan's teeth that you will get your money back.
The cost of one of Brendan's teeth.
I think that if you do a little bit of research and fill out some paperwork and send them the form from the dentist that did your work, that you will, and then also say that if there's a problem with this, you call Brendan McDonald.
Okay.
Try that.
I'll put the weight on him, huh?
And then if worse comes to worse, we'll take him to task on the air. You know, okay. I mean, that's ridiculous to pay that much money for teeth. You could have pulled it out yourself.
Tell me.
Yeah, the old string in the doorknob trick.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
where did that come from? That's like a cartoon.
The Three Stooges.
The Little Rascals.
Yeah,
right, the string
in
the doorknob.
Yeah.
All right, well, look, for those of you who are just tuning in or here or just getting up, here are a few highlights from what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. President Bush is excluding the CIA from National Security Council meetings. This is the worst snub against the CIA since the time the FBI refused to tell them who they hired to kill JFK. The CIA will return to doing what it does best, spying on American citizens and smuggling drugs. The Supreme Court rules against medical marijuana. The sad thing is that patients with chronic problems will now also have chronic problems. The DEA official said, finally, the Supreme Court has removed our handcuffs. Now we can launch our war against cancer and AIDS patients and the elderly. A sperm bank company is offering Viking sperm for the creation of Aryan babies. It's good news for men who can't father their own babies, but bad news for a lot of kids who are going to be named Thor Moskowitz. For any of you who are... disgusted by this trend toward blonde, blue-eyed babies, visit marinsperm.com, and a trained representative will discuss an alternate plan that's right for you when I get home. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Oh, great. A sperm bank that pumps out blue-eyed blondes. Just what we need. A world where everyone looks like Dolph Lundgren. Wake up, sheeple. There's no you in eugenics. Those are Morning Sedition's Cliff Notes for today. Tomorrow, Riley, we've got the ACLU's Ann Beeson.
Yeah, about the FBI's new McCarthyism. We got the founder of Craigslist.
Oh, yeah, he's going to talk about how Craigslist is going to start doing journalism.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting concept. This guy's a good guy.
Yeah, and we've also got, of course, a report from the front lines of George W. Bush's War on Brains.
Good show, Riley.
See you tomorrow.
Yep.
Good show, Air America Radio.